Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. All eyes are increasingly on Washington, D.C., where on Thursday at noon, President George W. Bush will be inaugurated for a second term. He will take the oath of office and deliver his inaugural address, and the pageant of democracy will be on. And we're going to be talking about that today. We're going to look particularly at the president's second term and at his second inaugural address. And here's the big question. What do you want this president to say? Just pretend again that you're the president's speechwriter. What do you want him to say? What do you want him to signal to the nation? What do you want him to tell the world about America's purpose, America's determination, and the president's plans for his second administration? We're going to be talking today about the importance of the inaugural address in American history. We're going to talk about the pageant of democracy in terms of the inauguration itself. We're going to talk about all this and how it came together. And we'll do that in just a moment in our second segment. But first, a report of current happenings and what is happening in some parts of the world is cold. And when we're talking cold, we're talking really cold. In Embarrass, Minnesota, they're not embarrassed to tell you that their thermostat reached 54 degrees below zero yesterday. Now, I grew up in South Florida. We thought 54 was cold. But 54 below zero is incomprehensible. Now, there are people who live in Embarrass, Minnesota. But there are only a few of them. And in this little town, there are only 691, and they are frigid souls. Christine Mackay, the town clerk for Embarrass, Minnesota, said this, "You keep living, but it gets old after a while." Well, I think 54 below zero, we get old pretty fast. The cold has reached down even to the Gulf Coast, where 28 is the temperature in Mobile, Alabama. And the hard freeze warning went all the way down into parts of Florida throughout Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, etc. So you're looking at cold across the nation. And it just seems that for some reason, the inauguration week is just stamped cold on the calendar. And 4 years ago, certainly cold in Washington, it looks like it's going to be cold again. Well, you thought that the difference between red and blue states was a matter of deep conviction. And perhaps you're one of those who's been thinking that Americans are actually divided over certain moral and political issues. Well, today's New York Times tells you you're wrong. An op-ed piece in today's New York Times, written by Joshua Friedman, is entitled, "This Is Your Brain on Politics." He goes on to argue that the Republicans and Democrats are more alike than we think. Now, we have talked on this program about various kinds of biological reductionism. That's a big name for what happens when you start treating human beings as chemical and biological machines rather than as thinking people. Whether you want to tie every kind of behavior to genes or you want to argue that everything's just a matter of behavioral conditioning or whatever, you're trying to avoid personal responsibility and the real differences between human beings. And Joshua Friedman's up to it in a big way, and he's brought some scientific data. Now get this, he is a part of a team that took 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats and examined their brains under an fMRI. That's a functional magnetic resonance imaging test. And guess what? Their brains are pretty much the same. Now, color me absolutely confused as to why this is supposed to matter at all. What in the world does it say that their brains are alike? Do we think that it is somehow just some chemicals in the brain that produces someone who's for and someone who's against homosexual marriage? Do we think that it just comes down to certain kinds of chemicals in the brain? It's just a computer at work reading off whatever chemical script is on there? This is the kind of ridiculousness that ought to be laughed at, but instead it finds itself in the very center of the op-ed piece of the New York Times. The op-ed page has it right there in the center with a picture of two brains. One says, "I'm going to vote for Bush, but I kind of like Kerry." And the other one says, "Kerry's my guy, but Bush isn't so bad." The problem is, Bush folks aren't saying that, nor are the Kerry folks. This is what you call denying the obvious. And this is where this scientist needs to take off his white jacket and go out and meet the public. And he needs to stop looking at magnetic resonant images of the brain and start talking to the people whose brains are doing the thinking. Listen to this. "This suggests that the passions swirling through elections are not driven by deep commitment to issues. We're not fighting over the future of the country. We're fighting for our team, like Red Sox and Yankee fans arguing over which club has a better catcher. Both are an election, both in an election and in baseball, all that really matters is who wears the team uniform. Where in the world has he been? The big story is that people have been changing uniforms. This would be absolutely irrelevant were it not for the fact it's in the New York Times, where the story underneath the op-ed piece is entitled, Where's the Rest of Him? It's by Errol Morris, a filmmaker and director who won an Academy Award last year for the documentary The Fog of War. He goes on and says that President Bush won the election because his story made sense and John Kerry's didn't. What's the story? The story of his personal narrative, the story of his personal values, and the story of all the rest. Now, I'm not sure I agree with that article in entirety, but I'll tell you what, it makes a whole lot more sense than the article that comes just before it. Speaking of making sense, who can make sense out of the decision of the editors of Rolling Stone magazine to reject an ad for a Bible? Zondervan Publishing attempted to place an ad for its new translation, the TNIV. We've talked about that, and by the way, we'll talk about that again. The issue today is really not the TNIV, but the advertisement, where Rolling Stone magazine has turned down an advertisement for this translation because it said it will not advertise with anything that has a spiritual message. This ad carries the slogan, Timeless Truth, Today's Language, and it was the word truth that evidently triggered the reaction from Rolling Stone. Now, Zondervan bought the ad space in July for February, so we're talking about a decision made just about a year ago, and it has now been rejected by the newspaper, by Rolling Stone, said, quote, it didn't feel quite right in the magazine. That said by Kent Brownage, general manager of Winter Media, who handles the advertising and is the parent company of Rolling Stone. Quote, the copy is a little more than an ad for the Bible. It's a religious message that I personally don't disagree with, he said, citing a spiritual message in the text. But he said, quote, we are not in the business of publishing advertising for religious messages. Well, that's interesting, since they advertise porn, since they advertise sexually explicit products, and since they will advertise, and for that matter, celebrate in their editorial copy, virtually any kind of perversity or anything on the far side of pop culture. That tells you a great deal about where we stand. By the way, God's not even mentioned in this article. But then again, religion, God, Christianity, the Bible were not mentioned in the sticker on the Cobb County textbooks that the judge ruled to be unconstitutional last week either. Shows you where the secularist worldview inevitably leads. I mentioned yesterday that Lawrence Sumners, the president of Harvard University, has been in trouble because of a speech he gave in which he suggested that one of the reasons why more men happen to be in the hard sciences and in the faculty of universities and colleges in the hard sciences than women might be because of some innate differences, biological differences between men and women, even cognitive differences. Now, he did not say that he believed this. He was listing a number of theories, arguments, and hypotheses as to why there is a disproportionate number of men in the hard sciences than women. Now, he did not say that men were smarter than women. He did not say that men were better than women. He simply said, in this particular field, it could be that there are innate cognitive differences between men and women. And I said yesterday that that made sense to me. Now, that doesn't mean that all men are always better in the sciences than all women. My wife was a summa cum laude double major in biology and chemistry. And I love her anyway. Frankly, I would consider that I would rather go into the gulag than have to major in biology and chemistry. But the fact is that there is, especially at the graduate level, especially those doing PhDs, there are simply more men than women who are attracted to those fields. And Lawrence Sumner said, look, there are a lot of reasons why women might not find those fields attractive, 80-hour work weeks, the social context. But he also talked about these differences, and the feminists have jumped all over him. Today, in the New York Times, there's a response from the Harvard chief. He said, I'm sorry for any misunderstanding, but believe that raising questions, discussing multiple factors that may explain a difficult problem, and seeking to understand how they interrelate is vitally important. But Denise D. Denton, the chancellor designate of the University of California, Santa Cruz, questioned Dr. Sumner sharply, saying that it was his responsibility, and now hers, to speak truth to power. Nancy Hopkins, I cited her yesterday from MIT, said this, when he started talking about innate differences in aptitude between men and women, I just couldn't breathe because this kind of bias makes me physically ill. Let's not forget that people used to say that women can't drive an automobile. Well, don't be insulted with this, Dr. Hopkins, but my guess is that if the shoe were on the other foot, no men in the audience would get physically ill and run out because they were afraid they were going to throw up. But then again, I guess I've just pointed to what could be an innate difference between men and women, and that just might get me in trouble with half the human race. If you don't think that male and female are different, How do you deal with the innate differences between boys and girls? And why would we think that we just grow out of that at some point? It's interesting, isn't it, that there's a rebellion against gender. God made us male and female for His glory. And He made us different. Not better, not worse, not inferior and superior. God put an order in creation, an order in marriage, an order in the family. He made men and women for each other, and He made male and female to be distinct. Commonly united in the image of God, but distinct in terms of certain aptitudes and roles. There's some people who just can't take that. And as Lawrence Umers has learned, just raising the issue can get you in hot water at Harvard University. We're going to be back to talk about President Bush's second inauguration. I'm Albert Mohler. Well, that's the kind of music that's going to be played all over Washington in coming days. The inauguration of a president is a big deal. It's the pageant of democracy. It's one of our constitutional traditions and one of our democratic customs. It says a great deal about who we are. We do not, after all, have a king to coronate. We do not have an emperor to enthrone. So what do we have? We have a president elected by the people who stands before the people in order to receive and to repeat an oath of office and to make his public pledge to execute his office in accordance with the U.S. Constitution. And also to deliver an inaugural address to signal to the nation and to the world his intentions as president. It's a very clear responsibility. It's a very rare challenge, frankly, for a president, an incredible opportunity to paint a picture for the nation to see, to establish a vision for the nation to follow, and sometimes to address the issues that are even then most urgently on the nation's agenda. That was the case when Abraham Lincoln took his first inauguration and delivered his first inaugural address with slavery and the impending Civil War threatening to divide the nation between North and South. It was very different in 1789 when President Washington became the very first chief executive. He received the oath of office standing on the balcony of Federal Hall in New York City. And he did so standing before the Congress, before the House of Representatives and the Senate that were assembled there on the street before him as he stood on the balcony. He took the oath of office, which, after all, is set down in the Constitution, but he established two customs that have continued to this day. First of all, he placed his hand upon the Bible as he was repeating the oath. That isn't in the Constitution. It was President Washington's decision, and that has continued all the way until President George W. Bush. He also did something else. At the end of the oath, he added the words, "So help me God." And every single president, from George Washington to the present, has repeated those words as well. Now, let's remember that the presidency as an office, the chief executive office, was largely designed around the person of George Washington. The framers of the Constitution saw him not only as the general who had led the American army to victory, but also as the president of the Constitutional Convention that held together that process so that the new nation would have a genuine federal system of government. George Washington was concerned that the nation needed a chief executive who would know how and when to speak. And he established the inaugural address as a prime presidential opportunity to set the theme, to set the agenda. As Alan Metcalf in his book on the American presidency has made clear, George Washington did not come to office by heredity, but by virtue of his virtue. I love that phrase. It was by virtue of his virtue. He was admired and respected by virtually all Americans. And as the nation's first chief executive, he set a tone, a pattern, a formality, for one thing, and of leadership. Leadership defined by both when the president spoke and when he was silent, by what he said and what he did not say, and by the kind of language presidents would use in framing the issues of the day. Let me give you just a few statistics about inaugural addresses, because after all, in the nation's history, there have been long ones, short ones, good ones, bad ones, memorable, and forgotten ones. The shortest inaugural address was George Washington's second address, when he basically said, "I've got the job, I'm going to keep the job, I'm going to do the job. If I don't do the job well, tell me about it." It was 135 words long. That must have been on the minds of the people who were standing in the snow at William Henry Harrison's inauguration. He delivered a speech of 8,445 words, nearly twice the length of any other president's. The address was delivered in the midst of a fierce snowstorm in bitter cold. He spoke for an hour and 45 minutes. It didn't so much kill his audience as it killed him. He died shortly thereafter. As one reference book on the American presidency puts it, he took the oath of office, delivered a lengthy and tedious inaugural address, appointed many men to office, called a special session of Congress, became ill, and abruptly died. Evidently, this kind of long speechmaking runs in the Harrison line because his grandson, President Benjamin Harrison, gave the nation's fourth most lengthy inaugural address. He clocked in at 4,388 words. The only two that were longer than Benjamin Harrison, but shorter than William Henry Harrison, were William Howard Taft and James Monroe. Some other inaugural addresses have made history because of their substance, of the tone. Not only was this the case in the first inaugural address of George Washington in 1789, it was certainly the case when Abraham Lincoln was first inaugurated into office. In the 20th century, we think of the inaugural addresses of Franklin D. Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy in particular as signaling a change in the nation's tone. President Roosevelt very clearly spoke of the need for change. He spoke of the reality of the national distress, and he made very clear that he intended to lead. And, of course, John F. Kennedy, the youngest elected president of the United States, saw himself as the leader of a new generation, and he wanted to make clear that America would take its place in the world. Let's listen, and again, some of these recordings are old and scratchy, but you need to hear the voice of American history. Let's listen to Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his first inaugural address, March 4, 1933.
This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
It's fascinating to hear the voice of Franklin D. Roosevelt and to understand that that voice invigorated a nation. I mean, just think back to this. There is the voice of Hudson River, New York aristocracy. That's the Dutch stock of the Roosevelt clan. And you could hear even in his intonation the fact that this was an insider of the insiders. And yet he arose to speak for Americans in order to lead the nation out of the Great Depression and, of course, through the travail of the Second World War. A man young enough to be Franklin Delano Roosevelt's son was inaugurated January 20, 1961. Another Democrat, John F. Kennedy, stood to describe his generation's role in history. Let's listen to clip number four.
We dare not forget today that we are the heirs of that first revolution. Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world.
You know, there are a couple of other snippets from John F. Kennedy's inaugural address that have just entered America's popular consciousness, and we just can't forget these. And one of them had to do with America's determination to fulfill its role in the world, and President Kennedy served a warning to the world. We're going to hear that when we come back in just a moment. We're going to hear President Kennedy warn the world, and we're going to hear President Ronald Reagan encourage America about what it could be in the brave new world, looking forward to the 21st century. We're talking about the American presidency and the ceremony of the inauguration. The phone lines are open. We'd love to hear from you. We're going to talk about what you would like to hear from President George W. Bush on Thursday as he takes the oath of office and addresses the nation with his presidential and inaugural speech. This is President George W. Bush's second shot, but it's his last. We'll see what he has to say, but what would you have him to say? Give us a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-8255. At the intersection of history and the future, We're talking about the presidential inauguration, and we'll be right back.
Listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're discussing the inauguration coming up on January 20. That's just Thursday. We're looking ahead to the second Bush term and just wondering what the president's going to have to say. I'd love to hear from some of you who would like to write the president's speech. You'd like to at least put some points in there, perhaps something of tone, something of substance. But when we dropped off, we were talking about President John F. Kennedy. And there is a certain sense in which I think the most important part of his first inaugural address and only inaugural address was not when he said, "Let not you ask what this country can do for you, but what you can do for your country," the most famous words. But rather, this warning to the world. Let's listen to clip number 5.
Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
Now, you look at the figure of John F. Kennedy, you realize he's a very controversial political figure. And quite frankly, more a matter of American political mythology than anything else, because there are still Americans who cannot look dispassionately at the political record nor at the personal character of John F. Kennedy. But you realize that he was, at that moment, assuming the nation's chief executive office. He was there representing the entire nation, and his first and only inaugural address is one of the most powerful speeches ever given by an American president. But we also think of other presidents who had enormous rhetorical and oratorical ability, and there was no one who could exceed Ronald Reagan in terms of the ability to give a speech that would really establish, both in terms of substance and style, where America should go under his leadership. Let's listen to clip number 13. This is Ronald Reagan.
It is time for us to realize that we're too great a nation to limit ourselves to small dreams. We're not, as some would have us believe, doomed to an inevitable decline. I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing. So with all the creative energy at our command, let us begin an era of national renewal. Let us renew our determination, our courage, and our strength. And let us renew our faith and our hope. We have every right to dream heroic dreams.
That was President Ronald Reagan in his first inaugural address, and it is still difficult to believe that was 24 years ago. We'll be on Thursday, almost a quarter of a century. The voice still sounds as live as if he were addressing that speech to us today. What would you have President George W. Bush to say on Thursday? Give us a call, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We're going to go to Doug, calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Doug, go right ahead.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. Thank you for taking my call. I kind of have a question for you. The influence that the speechwriters obviously carry on presidential and inaugural addresses, should President Bush want to make a bold statement, a counter to everything that has been said he can't say, how much will the speechwriters allow to take place should he want to make a strong statement about his faith? Obviously, as a Christian, I would want him to speak with conviction on that area, as they have allowed him and will allow him to do on his political stances. But how much of a role will they really play, and what kind of influence do they have over what the president actually says?
You know, that's a great question, Doug. And by the way, presidential speechwriters go all the way back to the very earliest years of the 20th century. And by the time you get to Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Truman and Eisenhower, they become a staple of the White House staff. And lately, they've become famous in their own right. I mean, for instance, just about everyone now concedes that John F. Kennedy's inaugural address was at least drafted in its original form by Ted Sorensen. And in the case of President Ronald Reagan and President George H.W. Bush, you had in the background writers like Peggy Noonan, speechwriter now famous in her own right. President George W. Bush is served by an outstanding group of speechwriters, including Mark Gerson. And, by the way, he made a very interesting presentation of how he does his work in a recent interview in the Washington Post. Doug, hang on. I'll be back to deal with your question in just a moment after we come out of this break. But let me just say this. The President of the United States is constrained by no one when he speaks. And even though these speechwriters have a hand in drafting what the President will say, in the end, it's his voice, these are his words, and he will say what he wants to say. And I can guarantee you this, President George Bush is going to say exactly what's on his mind on Thursday. This is the Albert Mueller Program. We're discussing presidential inaugurations, past, present, and future. And we'll be right back.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
That President John F. Kennedy, 1961, January 20, as he took the oath of office, representing a new generation and speaking very clearly with a different tone and substance than had been heard in previous inaugural addresses. And clearly, in the context of the Cold War, Kennedy was setting down a threat to the Soviet Union and Communist China and other nations. America is going to stand for liberty, whatever the cost. And, of course, the problem behind that is knowing just how far the nation was willing to cash the check that President Kennedy wrote. And that's one of the big questions that continues to face us even now. When a president speaks, is he able to lead the nation to realize the dream that he sets out? Doug is called from Louisville, Kentucky. We were talking about the role of presidential speechwriters. And Doug, before you go, let me just say this, that in the process of writing speeches, the president has to have help because the ceremonial demands of the presidency now are so immense that the president has to speak at all kinds of occasions. I mean, he's got to put out a proclamation for National Be Kind to Turkeys Day and, you know, just about everything. He's got to give a speech welcoming this ambassador and all the rest. Most of that ceremonial and perfunctory. But on big events like this, the president really does have a lot of input. You know, I think of two recent presidents who had speech writing teams, and that is Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. And yet both of them eventually came to the point where they drafted out what they wanted to say on yellow legal pads and then handed it over to speech writers who helped to organize it and all the rest. And then the last draft was in the president's voice. Doug, let me bring you back here. And you were talking about President Bush's upcoming speech. You said you want it to be in his own voice. What exactly would you want him to say?
I think Dr. Mueller, as born in 1977, I kind of make the cut for a Gen X generation. And my biggest concern is, I think beginning with me and moving on up, we're kind of a generation that says, please tell us really who you are. Please be straightforward with us. And I think I feel like the president, or at least the office of, is constrained sometimes. And I would love to hear George Bush at this speech really tell us who he is as a Christian and that he will, as he has in the previous term, lead this country by beginning every day on his knees. And I think through the time that he was in office, we lost some of that. We heard some of that at the beginning, and I think that was exciting to my generation and beyond.
Yeah.
But I think that we, again, need to hear from George W. Bush and hear him say, I am leading this country through the guidance I receive from Jesus Christ, my personal Lord and Savior.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what he does say. And, of course, President Bush got into a lot of hot water last time, 4 years ago, for even the prayers that were spoken at his inauguration. And I hope to hear that same kind of conviction in the prayers that are offered on Thursday. I'll be very disappointed if we do not. By the way, there are some who would be outraged right now at Doug's argument and at my statement because they think this would violate the separation of church and state. We won't even chase that dog. But let me just tell you, they would really be out of sorts with William Henry Harrison. I mentioned earlier his inaugural address. Just listen to this. This is his next to the last paragraph. He said this: I deem the present occasion sufficiently important and solemn to justify me in expressing to my fellow citizens a profound reverence for the Christian religion and a thorough conviction that sound morals, religious liberty, and a just sense of religious responsibility are essentially connected with all true and lasting happiness. Now, what if a modern president said that? You can imagine what the headlines would be the next day. But that was spoken by William Henry Harrison in his inauguration. Let's go to Kevin calling from Canton, Ohio, listening on WHK. Kevin, go right ahead.
Doctor, pleasure to speak with you. What I'd really like the president to do in front of the world audience is to step out front, certainly with his religious convictions. I feel he's a gentleman of strong character and knows Scripture well. But under the scrutiny of the world audience, if he could draw back to a simple phrase, the tradition of the United States, by the people, of the people, for the people, and the pursuit of liberty of peoples worldwide, I think he'd be making a general statement to just about every foe that we have worldwide that we're not going to sit back anymore, that we are an active participant in the world audience and part of the world itself. Our people are extending hands all over the world out of compassion. And I would like to also hear him drive the people of the United States to uphold their military service, to pass their religious convictions on to each other and to aid each other every day. And I hope sincerely that whatever he does say is greeted with the true definition of truth.
Yeah, Kevin, that's a very good point. And, you know, I think over the long haul, we judge American presidents, at least in part, by whether or not they live up to what they say, whether their words actually match their policies and their performance in office. With that in mind, let's go back and let's listen to a short segment from President George W. Bush's first inauguration 4 years ago on Thursday. That's clip 21.
I am honored and humbled to stand here where so many of America's leaders have come before me, and so many will follow. We have a place, all of us, in a long story, a story we continue, but whose end we will not see. It is a story of a new world that became a friend and liberator of the old. The story of a slave-holding society that became a servant of freedom. The story of a power that went into the world to protect but not possess, to defend but not to conquer. It is the American story, a story of flawed and fallible people united across the generations by grand and enduring ideals.
You know, when you listen to those words, you have to remember that that was spoken. Those words were spoken just about 9 months before September 11, 2001. Before there was any talk of war in Afghanistan or war in Iraq, when Saddam Hussein looked to be the invincible and permanent dictator of Iraq, you have to wonder if, looking back at those words, the president must now think that he was biting off a big responsibility for himself and for America with those words. And now, with the second inauguration coming just about a day and a half away, this president will now be sworn in for his second term with America at war and with America at changed place. It's going to come right down to the level of security and some of the customs and traditions that are going to have to be bent to the new security reality of Washington, D.C. We're living in challenging times. I'm confident that on Thursday, President George W. Bush is going to address a challenging message to the American people. But word coming out of the president's speechwriting team and out of the White House is that the president is going to issue a challenge to the world. Well, let's wonder what Europe, what Iraq, Afghanistan, the people on the West Bank and Israel, and in Asia and throughout the world are going to think of that. The president's not just speaking to America, but for America. I'm Albert Mohler.
We are a nation that has a government, not the other way around. And this makes us special among the nations of the earth. Our government has no power except that granted it by the people.
President Ronald Reagan there from his first inaugural address, January 20, 1981. President Reagan's second inauguration had to take place inside the Capitol rather than on the steps on the West Front simply because of the cold. It was so bitterly cold in Washington that they had, for safety's sake, to move the ceremony indoors. President George W. Bush's first inauguration 4 years ago was a frigid, messy, wet, and miserable day. And my wife and I simply froze, but we were happy inside. And we were happy for the nation, even as we were freezing with several thousand of our fellow citizens in the drizzling cold rain and snow. Well, we're going to be back this year, and we're hoping for better weather. But beyond that, we're hoping to see America's pageant of democracy go through and proceed so that the watching world will understand what it means to have a government that derives its sovereignty from the people. And to see a president elected and take office and make his pledge and take that sacred oath of office and do so in public view and with the knowledge that this is a stewardship he holds for a term, for a time, for 4 years. We are not coronating a king. We are not enthroning an emperor. But we are installing a president into office in an inaugural ceremony that makes it very clear that we have combined in one office the head of state and the head of government. We have created in the American presidency not only the man who is, at this point, the leader of this nation, but the individual who is, to a large degree, the most powerful office holder in the world. It makes a powerful statement that this is not a king like Philip II of Spain or Henry VIII of England. This is not a dictator like Mao or Stalin. This is an elected leader. This is a man elected by the people. He does not own this office. He bears, for a term, for a time, the stewardship of this office. This is a reminder not only that we should listen to President George W. Bush and gather our children and families in order to listen and watch democracy at work, but we must also pray for this president and pray that God will bless his second term. We'll be in Washington over the next 3 days. I'll be calling in to give you on-the-spot reports from the inauguration and events in the nation's capital. And Russ Moore will be standing in as our very capable guest host, and you will enjoy being with him over the next 3 days as I'm in Washington, D.C. We'll keep the conversation going, and we'll tell you what it's like in Washington. Come rain or shine, we'll be at the inauguration coming on Thursday. Day by day, this program is the meeting place for Christians who want to talk about the issues of the day, the place for intelligent Christian conversation where you can count and depend upon the fact that every day we're going to put truth on the line. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Moeller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.